This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by the Weather Channel. What does the Weather Channel app share in common with a personal trainer and a life coach? It's an ally on your quest to wellness. What you do with its insight is up to you. Like running an extra mile when air quality is good, or checking your allergy forecast so not even ragweed can disrupt your chi. It's more than a weather app. What in the weather are you waiting for? Be a force of nature with the Weather Channel app.
I'm Alex, and this is Time to Talk. Today is a good day. Why? Because you are here listening to this podcast, and so the day must be a good one. This week's episode is with actor David Harewood. David is well known for his role in Homeland as David Eastes. For the comic book lovers out there, he has been in Supergirl since 2015 and various spin-offs such as The Flash and Arrow. On his documentary side, he has done some informative shows which I found to be of personal value, such as Will Britain Ever Have a Black Prime Minister back in 2016, and much more recently and pertinent to our conversation, in 2018 he hosted a documentary called My Psychosis and Me for the BBC. In this episode, we have a look at his new book. It came out on September 2nd, and it's called Maybe I Don't Belong Here, a searing memoir about growing up black in Britain and going into poignant detail about his own journey with psychosis, identity, and the pain of loss. This is an emotional episode with themes of grief, so if you're sensitive to that for whatever reason, please tread with caution. We also spoke about being a black person in white spaces, and this was a brave conversation with a brave man, and his new book, Maybe I Don't Belong Here, is brave even more so. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Share the podcast far and wide. Let's get on with the show. It's time to talk in a heart-to-heart with the man himself, David Harewood. Hello, David. Welcome to Time to Talk. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here, and I am looking forward to this.
I feel like we're going to talk about everything, but we are here to talk about your new book that's coming out. And by the time this goes out, it would have been out already. Maybe I Don't Belong Here. Mm-hmm. And for people that listen, for the listeners who are long in the tooth and have been with me since 2018, even prior to that, but 2018 really, I have known that my whole thing has been about belonging. And what that means for us, it's one of my core values. It's one of the core topics of my book. And this just seems like a perfect fit to kind of have an expansive conversation on. And I wanted to know, just to start off at the beginning, like, what is your earliest memory?
Well, it will be having a brick thrown at me. And screaming for my elder brother, who I sort of idolized. My first memory was sort of being racially attacked. Looking for my brother, walking out the back door, looking for my brother, and somebody hurling a rock at me and hitting me on my head. Wow. And crying out for my brother. Mm.
What do you think when you think about that? Because that sounds quite scary.
you know yourself, when you write a book, you have to kind of sit with a lot of uncomfortable truths. And it takes me right back to childhood. It takes me right back to growing up in Birmingham, sort of fearful. I remember being very scared as a kid and becoming aware that I was other, that I was different, and that I had to be careful. And I always, you know, I remember, you know, rock coming through the window, and I remember sort of things people used to say, just a sense of fear as a child growing up in the 70s, a sense that I had to be very careful. I can remember my first day of school, which was probably about 5 or 6, you know, walking to school and walking to school with my mother and just being very scared, being very scared of the outside world, being very scared of, once I got used to the journey to school, I would sort of walk on my own. But that journey to school and that journey home from school was always fearful. Whether it was somebody shouting "nigger" from a car, or you know, a comment, or you know, being chased, a sense that, because back in them days, say you could be attacked on sight. Mm. I always just remember that sense of, you know, we talk now, it's become quite a bastardized word, but woke.
Oh, but yeah.
In its initial American iteration, it makes complete sense. Mm. Because as Black people, we had to be awake to threats. And whether those threats came from people or from violence or from attack. So I just remember those days very much having to be very awake to threats. And feeling, which is bizarre, because you know I had a lot of white friends and you know sat next to white people, but there was always a sense that if you met the wrong white person, you could be in trouble. Mm. So I just always remember watching white people and being very aware of particularly male voices screaming at me, and that sense of fear. That engendered.
So tell me about being at school, sort of thing, because the way I've understood it, we have our inner worlds, our own personal inner worlds, and we have our first system, which is the home, which is our houses and our families and the cultures that we're in. And then we kind of step out and we go into like a training ground for the real world, which is school. And I'm always interested to hear what people's experiences are like at school. I wasn't somebody who got into many fights. I kind of just moseyed on through the years. But I wanted to know, what was that like for you in the 70s? What was that like for you, being that if it was safe, if you felt unsafe walking to school and being outside the home, but then you're in the school now and there's literally no safety net other than the fact that you're of the same age as a lot of these kids? What was that like?
I found it very playful, and I think because I found the walk to school so scary, traumatic, once I got there, it felt like a very safe space for me, and I really enjoyed the ability to invent myself and be funny and laugh. I found that it was almost literally a playground, and I thoroughly enjoyed being amongst people. And actually, it's funny that, you know, I'm an actor. I love people, and I love being in a cast, and I love being in a group of people with a similar sort of goal. You know, with a cast, it's to, you know, perform the best play or to perform the best together. There's something very unifying about that. And I, that's what I liked at school. I liked the play and I loved being around people. So for me, school was joy. From the moment I went to the day I left, I enjoyed sports. I was never academic. So I was never really there to learn. I was really there to play and really there to share. And I think that's where my love of people came. My love of acting came because I was forever messing around. If I could make people laugh, that was my that was my high. You know, some people got a high off getting an A. Some people got a high off winning a playground race. I got a high off making people laugh and messing around. So I guess some people, teachers would call me disruptive, naughty. And I certainly had a sense that, you know, there were other kids in other classes doing more academic stuff. And I kind of have a sense that I was in maybe in the slow class, or I was in, you know, a class with, you know, the guys who could be easily distracted. But I was happy there. I was never interested really in you know, writing great essays and getting A stars and academia. I was just much more interested in playing, laughing, being a little bit naughty. That was, I just got off on that because it just seemed like fun.
Yeah. Pushing the boat out a bit.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. And I was, you know, there were guys who were, especially when I got older, there were guys who were handsome and had the girls and you know, sneaking behind the bike sheds with the girls. That was never my thing. So, you know, I guess to get a bit of attention, I just became a clown, you know.
How did that sit with your Bayesian parents?
They were, I'm lucky, I guess, in that my parents were very, you know, I could always sort of turn it on.
Yeah.
And I was getting B's and C's. I was never an A student. So B's and I could sort of turn up and get a B and a C. And parents' evening, the teachers would always say, David's such a lovely boy, and David's, you know, harmless, and David's, and that seemed to seal the deal. As long as I was polite, nice, not fighting and getting on with it, my parents were okay with that.
When did you realize that you were black, in a sense? When did that really dawn on you? Do you remember the point in when you sat down and you were like, I'm a black man, I'm a black boy?
And maybe a bit younger. And I was playing outside the back of my house, or front of my house. An old white guy was sort of walking past me. And he stopped. I remember seeing him stopped, and he just looked at me and he started walking towards me. But it wasn't a charge. So I was like, what's this guy doing? He was an old white man. And he was kind of coming towards me, and he got closer, closer and closer. And then when he was in within an arm's length, he sort of leaned in and said, get the fuck out of my country, you black bastard. And he stayed there for a while, his angry face. Red anger. I just remember it was angry, and I didn't understand what he meant. I was like, what do you mean? I thought I'm English, so I think I didn't differentiate between my black self and my English self. I just thought I was English, British, and that was the. I remember when he, because he stayed there for a while. And then he turned and walked off. And I was just thinking, what does he mean? Get the fuck out of his country. And then I started thinking, oh, I get it. I'm black. that must mean I'm not English. I'm other. And that's when I first had an inkling of how other, my otherness. And it really spanned me out because I didn't know what to do with it. And I would try and talk to my dad about racism, but he would never talk about it. Would never talk about it. My mother would talk more about it. But I guess when I was 7, that was the first time I really got it. And it was a very destabilizing experience.
Mm. Let's talk about your dad for a bit, actually. I love the name.
Romeo.
Romeo Cornelius Harewood. Love that. Love that. It's a rich name, you know? Mm. Like, you know, and a lot of these Caribbean men came with these rich names.
Alfonso.
Yeah. were you guys close? Were you guys all close as a network of a family?
We were. And it's a shame really because I really looked up to my dad, and he used to take us. He was really proud of his car. You know, there weren't many people who had cars, you know, back in them days. My dad had a car. He was always polishing it, cleaning it. He was really proud of his car. And he would take us on these long drives to Blackpool and to Real, Weston-super-Mare, to the beach. And I always remember sitting in the car with my family, looking out the window, watching the world go by. And that's when my imagination would always spark. And, you know, it always, but he was a quiet man. And you know, sometimes he would take me in his lorry. He drove a big lorry, and he would take me on these long trips, I mean, literally hours. And I was quite shy. Even with my dad, I was quite shy. I don't know whether that was a feature of Caribbean parents, but they seemed a little distant at times.
Yeah.
And he was a man of few words. So we'd both sort of sit there in silence for hours. But you know, occasionally he'd look across and say, "Okay," I'll go, "Yes, Dad." And that was all I needed. You know, that's all he needed. And we'd spend the whole journey listening to the radio. And I'd hear him laugh, or he'd say something and I'd laugh with him. I think when I, you know, when in my adolescent years, he had a breakdown when I was 12, 13, he had a breakdown. And he was never the same after that. And I found it difficult to talk to him after that. So he just became very distant, and even more distant. And even after I had my breakdown, I don't really remember talking to him about it very much. But he was a man of few words. And when you did try and talk to him, it was difficult to get words out of him. And I regret that. And when my career took off as an actor, I was busy traveling around, and I missed most of his latter years. And you know, I was in America when he died and flew home for his funeral. And I sort of regret not knowing my dad more. Not I always wanted to have this, you know, I sat on the sofa with my, I've been away for a good 5-6 years, and I sat on the sofa with my daughter just the other night. And we were watching, she's really a big fan of BTS, this Korean, huge Korean
K-pop. Pop band. Yeah. K-pop.
And I was just watching it, and I said, you do realize that how much cultural appropriation is going on here, don't you? She got it. I said, you know, all this movement, I said, all this stuff, I said, it's all black.
Yeah.
All influenced by black movement. their whole gestures, the way they're doing all this stuff, and you know, the way they're rapping. I said, it's all taken from Black culture. And she said, yes, Dad. She said, why is that? We had this really great conversation on the sofa with my 15-year-old daughter. I would have loved to have done that with my dad. I really would have loved to have had that opportunity to sit there with him and talk about what I feel, my insecurities about being Black, my worries, my vulnerabilities. But he was never available to me for that. Even when I tried to, he was never available for that. So,
yeah,
I regret it.
Yeah, it's a lot. When it comes to regret, I do think that there are parts of us that are attached to really intense parts of our stories, you know? Mm. Like when we look back and we start to think, okay, I could have done this, I should have done that. But, I've been, you know, on a process of learning self-compassion and really just being like, you know what, these are things that have happened and these are why they've happened, and I just have to just move with it. You know, my nan passed away end of 2019, and I was just like, you know, there are things, conversations I wish I had continued to have, you know, especially with the generation that your dad is in. They're in the same generation, and there are conversations you want to have. There are things around the Caribbean that you want to know. You want to know their story of how they got here. And it wasn't until the funeral that I was like hearing the story of how her and my granddad met. It was just done. It was just a done thing that we just thought that was just it. Like growing up, it was just they are together. There's no story. And then hearing the story, I was like, these guys were actually young, like young people at some point. And you just, I totally understand that.
There's a sense that there's a great generation that's going. There's a great generation that we're never going to see them again. You know, we're never going to see those pioneers, those guys who came over and carved a path for us. There's a sense that they're leaving us. My mom's getting older. She's struggling to walk now, and she's not going to be around. I love my mom. There's a sense that they're not going to be around for a while, for very much longer. And I guess there's a sense of guilt that I haven't done enough. I haven't loved them enough. Or haven't sat with them enough and asked them about stuff, you know. Why didn't I learn how to cook like my mum? Why didn't I say, Mum, show me how to do this and show me how to do this? And there's a part of the culture that's going. It's just cooking. There's a part of us that's going. We become these English people.
Things they feared.
No, man. Yeah. The connection is gone. Sorry about that. It just came.
No, it's absolutely fine. I had that exact same revelation. And then I looked at it and I thought, like, my nan, I spent a lot of time with my nan. Like, there's a thing about when you're a grandchild, you kind of just give them that extra, like, 20 years, because they're just like, yes, they have more things to teach you, more things to teach people. And
hey there, did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And my grand taught me loads of things about cooking and all of that stuff. And then as I grew older, went to uni and went through that. It's like I became more and more distant as I started getting into work and life got in the way and all these different things. And it just became phone calls and the like. And so when my nan passed, it was just like, it was that exact same feeling of just like, oh my gosh, like that generation is going. for a lot of my cousins as well, is like all of our grandparents were kind of just going like within months of each other. And we're just like, that's a whole generation of elders. Definitely taking on their stories because they're with us. They're with us. That whole generation, because you talked about the silence that your dad had, and the resilience that, you know, your mum had, you know, just kind of getting on with the stuff, you know, being the only black people. That whole generation has a level of resilience that holding on to all of that stuff. When you were speaking about your dad's breakdown, and when I was reading the story and I just kind of looked at that and I felt the shame, I felt the holding on to all of that stuff. And he felt betrayed. Essentially, did he? Is that something fair to say? He felt betrayed that we called the authorities.
A little bit, yeah. He was very unhappy with my mother, particularly, that she called the authorities. And he never forgave her. He never forgave her. And
you want to explain what happened, actually, just so people, just briefly.
Well, I was a little young, and you know, my family tell me, my sister tells me that because I was so young, I was shielded from most of it. But my brothers talk about holding my dad down, which must have been frightening for them and him. Because he was spinning and having, he was diagnosed with hypomania, which I still don't understand and it's never really been explained to me. But his thoughts were rushing and he was not sleeping and he was, you know, waking my mom up in the middle of the night and asking her bizarre questions, and you know, this was a man who worked hard every day of his life, you know, drove a lorry, got up at 5 in the morning, rain, snow, wind, rain, hail, walked to work, or would drive, you know, drive to work, drive his car to the depot, get in his lorry, drive all day, get his car, drive home. And, you know, he did that every day. You know, in the evening, started drinking in the pub with his mates, and weekends, pub with his mates. He was a strong man and very beloved of his peers, of his friends. But I think he just overworked himself. Because he sort of invented it, but he came up with the idea of doing this. He loved darts, game of darts. So he sort of invented this darts league. He ran this darts league and would write reports up in the paper every week of the results, tabulate the results, do the scores, and write a little report of the game, who beat who would get to the semis, and then at the end of the season, he would run all these, get all these trophies, he would run all these children's charities, he was doing so much. And I think he just overworked himself. Because as I said, I don't remember most of it, but I always just remember my dad. As a child, my dad left at early in the morning. I always remember his keys in his pocket, the sound of his keys jingling down the stairs. It always used to wake me up momentarily, just hearing this ching, 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 as he walked past my bedroom and down the stairs. And I didn't hear it for a couple of days. And I was like, what's going on? You know, Dad's not going to work. And then I came home one night and Mum said, you know, Dad's not very well and that he'd been taken to hospital. And we went to see him. And at the psychiatric hospital, he was so angry. He was angry and very unhappy. about being sectioned. And I didn't really understand why he was sectioned. I didn't understand what was going on. I just knew that he had spun out a little bit. And I didn't understand it. But I knew he wasn't well, mentally wasn't well. And when he came back, he just wasn't the same man. And still ran the darts league, still drank a hell of a lot, but he was just different, just a different man. And never forgave my mother, never forgave the authorities, got quite belligerent. You know, was very belligerent and quite, you know, he'd puff himself up a lot. I'm this and I'm that. They don't understand. I know what I'm doing, and you kind of humor him a little bit, but he was never the same after that. And communicating with him was not easy after that.
Yeah. When you were 23, then you went through your own experience of a psychotic breakdown. And the first question I have is, did you feel a sense of betrayal at all when it came to being sectioned and then going through that experience yourself? And also, what was the lead up to that result?
The lead up was years in the making. I think, you know, I talk in my book about growing up in the white space. You know, I think it's very, you know, it's interesting how last year when there was a black family in a Christmas advert, there were complaints.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are complaints when there are too many black people on television.
Yeah.
As a black person, we grew up bare white people on television. There were only white people on television. And I think growing up in that white space, the betrayal I felt was thinking that, was being bamboozled into thinking that I was part of that space and that I belonged in that space. And then having, as an actor coming out of drama school, you know, when I became an actor, nobody mentioned my colour. At the National Youth Theatre, nobody mentioned my colour. I could play whatever I wanted. Nobody mentioned the fact that I was black. RADA, nobody mentioned that I was black. Yeah. I could play King Lear. I could play play anything. And I maybe naively felt that my colour didn't matter. Yeah. And that I was free to do. Maybe, and I do question that in the book, that maybe I became a clown, then an actor, almost to escape the sort of feelings of what I didn't understand blackness. I didn't understand how to develop develop my black consciousness as a child. I had no framework for that. And so I was assimilating all the time, assimilating. When you assimilate, it's all about not standing out. It's assimilate to the predominant culture, which was a white culture. You know, when I came out of drama school, the world categorically said to me, "You're black." And it span me out. And it was the first time I'd had to deal with serious questions from reviewers about, "Well, you're playing Romeo. What's it like playing Romeo and being black?" I just never had to frame my existence in such a tight box, or not a tight box, but I'm sure American children have that and they talk about having the talk.
Mm.
American parents will sit down and have the talk with a, yeah, with their black child.
You watch Blackish? Do you watch Blackish?
I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, there was an episode on there about the talk, and then I like the way they break it down to the masses. Yeah.
I think I remember that episode or seeing that episode. And I never had that. I never had, I was aware that I was, I was always aware that I was a bit different than othered. And, but I think the big challenge came when I left drama school, because suddenly my aspirations were suddenly challenged. You might, maybe in the back of my mind, I thought, maybe I'll play James Bond. Maybe in the back of my mind, maybe I'll play the hero of the story. And suddenly I was realizing that's just never going to happen because I'm black. And I'd never put any limitations on my imagination.
Mm.
And suddenly I'm realizing that even my agent was saying, oh yeah, but you can't play that. We'll put you up for that, but not that. And it was unspoken. It was all unspoken. That I would go for these roles and not these roles. And it was sort of a growing realization that I had to adjust my sails. And I even had people saying I had too many white friends. I had people saying I should be blacker. I had people saying, you're the new black hero. You should be like this. You shouldn't talk like that. You should talk like this. And I just became really unsure of myself. And even the black space was rejecting me because I came out of RADA speaking in this clicked English RP voice. So black people were like, we're not sure of this guy. Black women were like, not sure of this guy, and it was really uncomfortable. And so I began to doubt myself, question myself, lose confidence in who I was. And eventually I think that led to me just, as well as a couple of other things, just overthinking it and smoking a lot of weed, drinking a lot of booze, staying up too late. And I just lost control of my thoughts and my mind. And before I knew it, I was spinning. And I remember a drawing I have, which I still have, that secret agent man, who could be anybody, do anything, be anyone. He could, that whole James Bond thing where, you pretend you're the waiter and, you're really James Bond, but you're pretending to be the waiter to get into the function. I thought being the secret agent man, I could just be anybody and rise above cultural arguments, rise above the attacks from my black peers, rise above the attacks from the white space, and invent a person who could exist free of racial baggage. And that just, it's impossible. And I came a cropper.
I was actually a similar age. Oh my gosh. I was 24.
There's a lot of changes in us going on in those days. It happens a lot in adolescence because we change from boys to men. So there's a lot of chemical changes going on in the body naturally anyway.
Yeah.
You put on top of that all these deep questions of identity. It's a fireworks, man.
One of the questions I did have for you was about going into acting, and I sat there and I had a plethora of careers I could have chosen to go to, and I did consider drama school. I did a part-time drama student, but that was more for me to do public speaking and be able to have a bit more presence in these kind of realms as well. So. And just to be more confident in front of people. But prior to that, I was looking at, all right, what would it look like for RADA and, Central School Speech and Drama and all these places. I have friends that went to RADO and they were kind of giving me advice and things like that. But then I ended up going into journalism because I wanted to write and I wanted to speak about... There's a whole thing in journalism about truth when it comes to writing factual pieces and actual documenting journalism, and I wanted to get to that. I wanted to be able to write about that. But the major question I had was about, as Black people, we start to enter into these professions that have been, you know, occupied and populated by pretty much the white middle class for so long. So when we step into those places, I remember my cousin very much saying to me, because I was struggling in the newsroom and I was struggling in the paper that I was in, and he said to me, you have two options. You can push against everything that is happening. It's going to stress you out. It's going to push you. Or you can assimilate to what's happening in the newsroom. I kept pushing. And that's when I started to have the panic attacks at work. And I started to have all of these issues and all of these things that are going on. And so the major question was, how do we choose these environments to go into? Thinking that it's going to be what we think it's going to be. And then it's just not. Like, I was a Black journalist. I was a journalist who arrived on a scheme. I wasn't like the other journalists who were trusted, given stories that would prove their worth in their career. I wasn't doing that. I was given the small little bits. I had amazing stories, but when I give them in, they were clipped down to be very small, or they were shared with these other journalists. And I was always on a second byline, because, like, you know, in a paper, when there's a second name, it's usually the person who's supporting the story, not the person who's anchoring it. And it's just, so it was all of that. And that kind of led me to where I had to go through. When you had what you had, what was the breakthrough that happened? I've always looked at breakdowns as a beginning of a breakthrough. I've always looked at it as a spiritual kind of push. Something isn't aligning right, and
I see my breakdown as a breakthrough. And yes. I think that I call it you know, passing through post traumatic stress to find post traumatic growth, because after my breakdown, I was a whole lot more conscious of the struggle, who I was. And it was almost like it just, the rose-tinted glasses just got taken off and I saw the world clearly. And it's a shame that had to happen, but I'm almost grateful for it. I'm very grateful I came through it. You know, look, you know, people would say, you know, to a young Black kid who wants to be a policeman, why are you going to be a policeman?
Yeah.
But you might think, no, it's a good job and I want to change it. You know, and maybe one could argue it's the only way it's going to change is if you populate that body with more and more Black people. I mean, it hasn't particularly worked in America. In fact, I would say still the biggest threat to Black people in America is the police. So it may not quite be the same here, but you know, we only yesterday they released figures that police tase Black people for longer and easier than any other race.
It's 2021.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary where we're at, and which is why the title of the book is, you know, maybe I don't belong, because there's a whole load of people. I mean, speaking to a lot of people from Africa, and they're telling me, yeah, I'm going back. You know, there's a lot of Jamaicans moving to Ghana. There's a lot of Americans moving back to Africa.
Take me.
I'm thinking, maybe I'm, you know, so I don't know, living in this framework. You know, I'd love to be comfortable. I'd love to not have these hang-ups. You know, I got a lot of loss. And within a day, shoulders drop, relax, even though they still call me an Englishman.
Yeah.
Well, I'm relaxed, man. I'm relaxed and unfearful, and I just don't have this thing that I have here. You know, I turn my TV on here, and again, you know, there's a sprinkling of black people, but over there, you just turn your TV on and you go, yeah, I'm in a black country. You know, when I go film in Africa, I'm in Africa, and I feel very relaxed.
There's a book that I would suggest to you to read if you've not read it at all. It's called My Grandmother's Hands by a man called Rezma Menakem. At the point of recording, his Breakfast Club interview should be out, so you may be able to watch something of his today. But he's someone I admire as someone who's training in healing and working with people, and he's probably similar age group to you, but he speaks about brown, black and brown bodies, white bodies, and police bodies, and the trauma that we all experience in that way. And I do a lot of work, a lot of research, and with my clients as a coach around the nervous system. And black people, when we step out of our homes, our nervous systems are shot because we are tense. There are things we have to be aware of in ways that other people don't have to be. And quickly before I go on to something else, I read there's a bit in the in your book, and mention it just after you speak about the NHS Mental Health Act and black minority people suffer elevated rates of psychosis and schizophrenia compared with white people in the UK, and a far higher rate than black people of a similar age in the Caribbean. And you say, when I think about it, I'm not surprised at all. White British culture can be deceiving. It can make you feel like you belong and that everything is normal. But if you don't consciously monitor your thoughts and experiences carefully, every single resentment you've had, every single rejection, all the stress and hard paddling you've done can build up and break you, leaving you a shell of yourself, relying on tablets to keep yourself together. When I've spoken about it, I've always said, I feel like a shell of myself. I feel like a shell of myself. I feel empty. I feel hollowed out. Especially after those experiences, before I said I'm leaving this industry completely, I felt like a shell of myself. And so reading those words really had me just like, reminded me of just, in speaking about, you know, the diaspora, everybody is looking to go back home. Home is what it's called, you know. Everyone's looking to go back home. Everyone's thinking about about what it's like when they're with their family on the islands that they come from. Not everybody can go to the Isle of Scilly and say, oh my gosh, this is home, this is where I'm from. I can feel accepted wherever we go, because a large amount of the time, black people, people of colour, black and brown people typically have to think about when they go on an Airbnb to try and book a place, are they going to be rejected for the spot? When they arrive in a small town in Penzance, are they going to be looked at like left, right, and centre? Like, so, 100%. Yeah.
In a way, you know, and I have the same thing with some of my white friends. They say, oh, yeah, well, you know, because I was snowboarding I took up snowboarding when I was in Vancouver.
Vancouver.
I've always wanted to do it. I loved it. And, you know, I'm now living. The contract's done, so I'm not there anymore.
Oh, okay.
And I was thinking, oh, this is the first winter in 4 years I'm not going to be snowboarding. And my friend who took me up this, oh, you should just go to France, or you just go to Austria. And I was like, immediately you kind of go, really? Just go to Austria, where the Nazis were, where there's lots of There's lots of white people. Yeah, you know, which is why I'm sort of a little bit like, call it about Brexit. You've literally, not only have you cut me off from Europe, but in a sense, I'm like, in a way, I'm like that because I don't go there anyway. Because, you know, because as you say, you know, you turn up in Spain and, you know, I speak very well. You know, I'm on the phones at the airport. Yes, I'm going to be there in 5 minutes. And then you turn up and they go, oh. We know that. We know that feeling. And yeah, man, it's they don't have, I don't think they really understand, which is sort of why I wrote this book and why I write it from my earliest memory. Because people keep talking to us and saying, it's in the past, forget it. It's not like that anymore. They don't understand that that is the fabric. It's in the fabric of who we are, particularly me. It's in my blood. Those experiences make up who I am. That Union Jack, which is proudly flown by all of them Conservative MPs who are trying to say, yeah, it should be in every school, it should be in every household. I'm going, sorry.
It's a red flag for a lot of people. It's a trigger warning for a lot of people.
And I would, you know, black people understand that. If you're walking down the street and you see a white van covered in jacks, that's danger, man. It's danger.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
How do you keep yourself together?
I see a therapist every week, talk to him. And I've had two therapists in my life. The first was a middle-class white lady, and that was very helpful. I think I had issues around women and my treatment of women, which I think she was very helpful for. But after my documentary went out, I was really vulnerable. And it just, the first thing I read when I looked at my notes in that documentary was in the sequence, I'm supposed to go and collect my medical records and read some and talk about it. And the first thing I read was Merged Hearts with a Young Black Boy. Man, that just sliced me in two. It scared me, and I'd forgotten just how much my race had confused me at the height of my madness.
Merged Hearts of a Young Black Boy.
It really scared me. So I had sought out a black therapist and I met a male. And he's been tremendously helpful for me. And you know, it's almost in my head, you know, I'd become so confused. I worked out this out when writing the book, but I think I'd become so confused that I want in my confused head, hallucinating and babbling and deluded, I kind of set course for my younger self.
Yeah.
That's the boy I had to save. That's the boy I'd merged hearts with. I needed to get back to that boy before I became confused. The therapist says the same thing, that what would you do? Talks about holding his hand, holding that little boy's hand and taking care of him. I don't think I'd done that for a long time. And I do now. And Mm. Trying to take care of myself. I'm going to try and take care of that little black boy who just got lost and confused and twisted. So I take care of myself now.
For sure. For sure. That disconnection is so, it's so prevalent. And, you know, we don't, and I think we take it for granted a lot of the time. And it's like what we were saying earlier around trying to exist in this world and just kind of pushing forward and consistently being like, I'm going to do this. And you just really detach yourself from that boy, you know? So also, I've definitely been there.
You also, there's so much toxic masculinity. I mean, how we're talking now, it's a wonderful conversation, vulnerable conversation. But as black men, we don't do it. And, you know, it's almost like we prize the gangsters, the rappers, the man who's got six kids from, you know, three different women. And, you know, there's so much. I mean, I understand it. I understand why that is seen as strength, but it's toxic for us, man. And I wish there were. I hate the fact that kids dumb themselves down because they don't want to seem too white.
Mm.
You know, or that kids who get straight A's are sneered at, you know, by some of their peers for being too white. I hate that. I hate the idea that education and being smart and clever is the only way we can express our magnificence is the flash car, the money, the women. You know, I wish our youth, and that's where I lament the loss of connection with that great generation, because there's kids growing up there, never been to Jamaica, never been to Africa, never been to Barbados, never been to the West Indies. All they know is this.
Mm.
And this don't give them anything. Doesn't give them anything.
Mm.
It's tough. It's tough for them to try and be sensitive young men in this concrete fucking jungle.
For sure. Because the hunger is just so much more. And this is why we see such huge disconnections and such huge disconnects in our communities and the disparities and, you know, and the separation and how not every experience is the same, but they have similar elements. And it's about minding that gap.
But like, at the same time, you know, those two friends of mine in my documentary, saved my life, basically. You know, one of them's a teacher, and he's now an acting teacher. And, you know, he got caught up in a real ice storm with some younger black actors who were at his drama school. They were very aggressive and demanding more black plays and more black directors and more black, which is absolutely justifiable. You know, he said, you know, I went to school with, you know, he said, you know, do you know David Harewood? And, you know, I went to school with him, and, you know, he didn't find that necessary. And they said, well, he's a fucking coconut. And I was like, oh, but I can't, those are arrows that sometimes hit me that, you know, I'm much more, I'm happy with who I am. But I understand that anger. I can completely understand that. And I understand their desire for more culturally appropriate plays and more culturally appropriate directors and subject matters. I understand that. The fact that I didn't have it, I think is, and my therapist says this, he says it to make me feel better, but, you know, I wouldn't have the career I have if I wouldn't be playing the head of the CIA if I hadn't have assimilated the way that I have. I can present this very classic central thing that people are attracted to. And I would maybe not, maybe if I would have been, you know, if I hadn't have gone down this kind of assimilating route that I did go down, I wouldn't have had the career I've had. I've been very lucky. So
yeah. Well, I watched Mountaintop, and I remember sitting there very keenly at the balcony. I forgot. I think it was the Hackney Empire. I think it was.
It was Trafalgar Studios.
Trafalgar Studios. That's what it was. That's what it was. That sound. That rings the bell. It was at Trafalgar Studios, and I was taken aback, and I couldn't believe that. When I found out you were British at the time, I was like, "What?" I was young. I was what, 16 or something. I do want to say thank you so much for joining me on this show today, David. And you are welcome to come back whenever you wish.
I'd love to. Let's make it.
Yeah, for sure. Everybody, this is his book, Maybe I Don't Belong Here. And that is out on September 2nd. And it will be on my book list, on my reading list for September. So go out and get the book and engage. Let me know what you think about the book. Let me know what you think about his stories. And thank you so much, David, for coming.
Thank you very much for having me on.
This episode was edited and engineered by Pure Creation Media. Thanks again to David Harewood for joining me. Don't hesitate to get in touch. And until next time, thank you for your trust. Bye.